The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Nicola Davis. Coming up on the show, are humans transitioning as a species? Are we beating Mother Nature at her own game? And what does the future hold for Homo sapiens? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Juan Enriquez and Steve Gullens are co-founders of XL Venture Management, which builds startups in synthetic biology, big data, and new genetic technologies. Juan is an author and an authority on the economic and political impacts of the life sciences. He was the founding director of the Life Sciences Project at Harvard Business School. Steve was a professor at Harvard Medical School for 18 years, applying breakthrough technologies to diseases such as cancer, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's. They join us down the line from Boston, Massachusetts. In the studio, we have Mark Thomas, Professor of Evolutionary Genetics at University College London. Mark is known for his publications in the fields of human demographic and evolutionary history inference, molecular phylogenetics of extinct species using ancient DNA, cultural evolutionary modelling, and molecular biology. Juan and Steve, you've just published a new book called Evolving Ourselves, where you take a look at what the future holds for humans as a species. Perhaps we can start with the idea that you call Darwa 1.0. This is sort of the traditional ideas of evolution that we have that come back to Darwin and Wallace. What do you mean by Darwa 1.0?
Basically, it means that for 4 billion years, what lived and died on this planet depended on the two principles uncovered by Darwin and Wallace. So it was natural selection and random mutation. What actually survived, what reproduced, was based basically on are you smarter, faster, fitter, better looking? The natural selection principle, and then you would get occasional random mutations like giving human beings blue eyes.
What's changed? What's Darwa 2.0? What is this idea that we're embracing now? How have ideas of things that are influencing evolution changing?
So what humans have done is they've created a completely parallel evolutionary system. And what lives and dies today depends on principles that are almost the opposite of Darwin and Wallace, which is unnatural selection and non-random mutation. And let me unpack that. So probably a quarter to a third of humanity would not be alive under natural selection today. But because we've chosen to protect people, because we've chosen to vaccinate people, because we've chosen to treat people for diseases that would naturally kill them, a whole series of people, animals, creatures, plants are alive today. And let me give you one example of that. A cornfield is the least natural environment you will find on Earth. You will never walk through a forest and find only one kind of plant growing at the same time in orderly rows for our purposes and nothing else growing there. So we unnaturally select what lives and dies on enormous fields because we want only corn there, because we want only sheep there, because we want only wheat there, because we want a city or a garden that looks exactly like what we want. And that is not nature selecting, that is human selecting. And then the second part of this is we've reached a point where inserting genes, in using genes, in using antibodies, in inserting proteins, in modifying life code, we are practicing what, to use a politically incorrect term, would be intelligent design. So it's not random mutation, it's not let's breed these things to see what happens, it's if I insert this gene here, if I alter this life code in this way, then it will do this. And that is not random.
And the examples you've sort of given there are mainly to do with sort of plants or perhaps even animals. But this is presumably you're also saying here that we're using some of these techniques to influence human evolution. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. So when you insert a retrovirus into a human body to treat a disease, you are modifying the course of nature in the sense that human beings and human evolution, one of the biggest single forces driving human evolution has been disease and plagues and people getting wiped out, including a quarter of the population of Europe, in an all-natural state by bubonic plague or by smallpox or by polio or by tuberculosis. When you insert life code into somebody's body in the form of a vaccine to create an antibody, when you insert a retrovirus to cure AIDS, what you're doing is you're modifying life code in an unnatural way. But by the way, the unnatural has often been incredibly beneficial to human beings. Among other things, it's doubled our lifespan over the last century.
Mark, let's bring you in. Perhaps you can give us a sort of feeling about how current pressures on human evolution kind of compare to sort of previous pressures, like what we've been subjected to over the course of history.
Well, natural selection pressures change all the time. I mean, in any species, they will change all the time, and that's not the only force shaping evolution as well. What I'd be interested to know is when they think this unnatural evolutionary process started.
Humans have always taken control of their own local environment. They've actually designed things from farming to modern practices of industrial revolution, etc., to modify their own world to benefit themselves. This has taken on a much larger scale and accelerating pace over the last 2 to 3 centuries, to the point where no longer are things just changing local environments like a small tribe or even a village, where now it's on a global scale across most of humanity in most species. So it's really been in the last couple of centuries we've seen this acceleration, and it's continuing today at an even faster pace.
We've been modifying things like mustard weed for centuries, if not millennia. And when we breed mustard weed in specific ways, we get cauliflower or we get kale, other plants that are derived by breeding specific stuff. But there's been a step change in the scale, speed, and reach of these breeding processes, and also in the deliberateness of these breeding processes, which I think is a breakpoint.
So it seems to me that it'd be very, very difficult to actually define a clear-cut difference between natural and unnatural selection. It seems, I mean, they all work by the same basic principles, right, that they affect survival. But in humans, we have an unusual form of information transmission beyond genetic transmission, which is culture. I mean, there are many species that have culture, but we're the only one that has cumulative culture. And that has so reshaped our ecology that it is now, and has been, I would argue, for at least 50,000 years, the primary component of our ecology and the primary determinant of who survives and who doesn't. So it, fundamentally, if you do not fit into your group, you're not going to survive. I would argue that kind of cultural life support system that we have has been around for a long time, certainly for more than 50,000 years, and that no human is viable without it. There are no wolf children and there are no Tarzans or anything like that. And so you could therefore argue by your criteria that this unnatural, which I'm fairly uncomfortable with this term, but this unnatural evolution has been going on a lot further back than the origins of farming, which is only in the last 10,000 years.
So let me give you an example. One quick way of seeing how a Darwinian system would operate and how an unnatural system would operate is to take 1 square mile of land anywhere you want and leave it as is, as has been managed today, and take the square mile next to it and just leave it fallow for a decade and watch what happens to both of those things in terms of what lives and what dies on that square mile. And I think what you'd find is the differences on a small farm in England 5 centuries ago versus what was living a couple of miles away would have been pretty extreme. And today the differences between what would happen if you left a square mile absolutely fallow for 10 years and the rest of the environment would be absolutely dramatic.
But all species affect their environment to some extent, and that therefore affect the ecology of other species in the same location. You always have this interacting network. So, okay, we become a part of wheat's ecology, we become a part of barley's ecology or something like that. But that still fits within the standard evolutionary framework. So we have interesting additional processes. So we have what is generally scientifically termed niche construction, the process by which an organism can change its environment in order to make that environment better suited to the organism. But we're not the only ones that do that. Bacteria do that. Various species do that just by changing the environment. Also, various species will effectively farm other species. So termites will farm various types of fungi and so on. And so in a termite mound, you might see the only plant or fungi species, one species, because they're farming it. So are they indulging in unnatural evolution as well, or unnatural selection?
I think it's a matter of degrees. I think what Steve was arguing, which is completely correct, is scale, speed, reach. And as you think about that, we have a, I guess what you'd call a typically American television show, which is called Naked and Afraid, where they take two people who are ostensibly very good at living in the wild, and they put them in a boat, and they take away their shoes, and they take away their clothes, and they take away their mosquito repellent, and their food, and their lighters, and their matches, and their mosquito nets, and they drop them on the coast of Panama or on the coast of Borneo in a jungle, and then they film what happens to two human beings in an all-natural environment, and it just isn't pretty. And if you want a contrast as to how extraordinarily we have modified our environment and what happens to human beings and what would happen to human beings' survival and who would survive to reproduce in an all-natural scenario where we didn't change our environment to this extent, I suspect a big chunk of humanity would not survive.
Well, I would suspect that nobody would survive. As I said, I think that, you know, that a critical part of our ecology is culture. That's what we're ultimately primarily adapted for, is to live in the cultural milieu that we've created. Those cultural processes themselves are evolutionary processes subject to the same standard rules of evolution. I mean, for evolution, you just need three things. You need variation, you need transmission across generations, and you need differential survival. All of those still work biologically. All of those still work in a culturally evolving system as well.
In Darwin's day, he was very aware of humans intervening in breeding of animals and breeding of hybrid plants, etc. But he was very clear to distinguish that nature was the more powerful force in the determination of natural selection across the planet. And so what we've seen in the last 150 years is a revision of that idea on several levels. One is the idea that evolution takes long periods of time, I think, has been refuted by a number of examples that exist from your colleagues, yourself, and others, that things can happen very, very quickly. The pace at which things is happening is unprecedentedly fast with global warming, etc. And the idea that a traditional natural approaches to survival and reproduction for humans are completely altered because the likelihood of living to reproductive age is much higher than it was 150 years ago. And the ways in which we reproduce and pass on genes that ordinarily wouldn't have gone on to the next generation through fertility and in vitro fertilization have changed as well. And you're right that some people could call that natural because humans are a natural being that have created that. But from our perspective and from the perspective of how traditional evolutionary principles have worked, it feels more unnatural than natural to say that 7 billion people have not altered the fate of most species on this planet. Feels like a very unnatural statement.
Do you both feel that you've evolved beyond those people in your families 10 generations ago?
I think the epigenetic traits that we are carrying and passing on would probably be very different. Because the kinds of things we've been exposed to in terms of hunger, in terms of disease, in terms of pressure, in terms of information, yes. And I think, let me push your question 10 generations forward. Do you think that instruments like gene drives, and do you think that instruments like CRISPR could alter people significantly over the next 10 generations? The answer, I think, would be an unequivocal yes.
And are you including, it sounds as if you're including epigenetic changes, which are not going to lead to changes in the DNA code. It sounds like you're including those in your definition of evolution.
Absolutely, in terms of whether phenotypic traits that enhance survival and actually change your behavior are occurring over time. Not that they're not irreversible, but DNA changes are reversible as well.
But the epigenetic changes can happen within someone's lifetime.
And they can be transmitted across many generations, as we know. A single event in one generation can show up three generations as a change in the trait or phenotype or a stressful behavior.
Well, I mean, the whole point about epigenetic changes is that's a capacity to respond to changes in the environment and also possibly to genomic competition. That is already evolved anyway, so that capacity already exists. Do you think that our epigenetic capacity has changed?
I think our epigenetic capacity is a bit confused. We were, as a species, over millennia generated biological programs to adapt to stress, hunger, famine and violence and things like that, and we have epigenetic programs that allow the next generation, subsequent generations, to come into the world with a more hardy phenotype to survive that. Now when you throw a modern society at those genetic programs, modern living in cities, plenty of food, etc., I think you're finding changes epigenetically that have outcomes that we don't expect, we're surprised by.
And it goes beyond epigenetics. So when you ask the question, have the two of us changed? I think we all know people who've changed. And let me give you a couple of examples of that. If you go through cancer treatments, through chemo and radiation, one of the things that is going to happen, probably, is that they're going to give you somebody else's bone marrow. And when you do that, you can change somebody's blood type. You can change the sex of many of the cells in that person's body. So you're changing some pretty fundamental aspects of that person. Reasonably soon, in fact, actually not reasonably soon, 20 years ago, you began to have what you're debating in the UK right now, which is three-parent children to treat mitochondrial disease. And you've already had children who've been born to three genetic parents. So while I have not undergone cancer treatments and have not had some fundamental aspects of my body changed, many people have, and some people have now been born with a very different genetic makeup than is traditional.
What do you mean traditional? So any of the techniques that you've just talked about can be used to generate somebody with a certain genetic complement, but is that genetic complement impossible naturally?
It is exceedingly rare naturally, and it is random.
Every single genomic makeup of every single person that's ever lived is highly improbable.
Right, and what we're doing is we're beginning to say we are going to make the following traits more probable and more common. And when you begin to guide it in that way and when you begin to structure it in that way, then you are the person deciding traits, you are the person deciding what lives and what dies, and you're doing it for viruses, you're doing it for bacteria, you're doing it for plants, you're doing it for animals, you're doing it for humans. And what that does is it creates a second parallel evolutionary logic.
Doesn't every species, every sexually reproducing species on Earth do that simply by choosing who they mate with?
So this comes back to the scale and speed, and I think what many people would view as natural, as being unnatural, is something that doesn't generally occur. The idea of having three parents, it's not something most people, I believe, can view as a natural phenomenon that would occur on its own in nature.
Can I just jump in and ask a question there? You talk about our ability to harness genomes and to decide what sort of traits we're going to ensure get passed on, or perhaps which ones we want to make sure don't happen. You mentioned sort of CRISPR, and obviously there's been a lot of debate over here about the use of that sort of technology. I mean, it sounds like you sort of seem to think we have nature in a bit of a headlock. I mean, to what extent are we still subject to the influence of random mutations and sort of what you might call traditional evolution?
Take the example of dogs. So dogs are completely unnatural beings. They originated a few thousand years ago in Central Asia. They were bred out of wolves. We have bred them because we like, you know, pointers, or we like dogs that fit in Hermes bags that you can walk down the street with. We've bred them to be giant protectors or cute poodles. And in the measure that we do that, we've taken basically random stuff and bred it very specifically. Now, the big difference today is that even though we've been doing that for centuries or millennia, our ability to guide that, to design it, to speed that up, to insert genes at specific places, to read an entire genome, to reproduce an entire chromosome, to alter the basic biology of things, has just absolutely radically changed in the last 30 years. So yes, there is still random mutation going along, but the speed at which random mutation changes a bacteria or a virus or an animal or even a human is a completely different order of magnitude from what an instrument like CRISPR can do. With CRISPR is you know, just incredibly powerful stuff, and it's down at a college kid's level, which is why you're having all these very high-level meetings saying, hey, what are we going to do with this instrument that is here and now and cheap and easy? And that's the debate we have to have, right? I mean, I get a little frustrated sometimes because I think we're in a debate over terms and gradations and shades of gray at a time when we really have to start debating. We have never had instruments of this order, magnitude, and power, and we're responsible for them, and how are we going to use them? And that's the debate we really have to have.
So take an example of CRISPR-Cas9. So this gives us the ability to change particular parts of our genome to replace particular sequences in our genome. So let's say you do that and you generate an individual that has that particular change. Well, that change could occur by mutation. And it's not fundamentally the mutation rate itself that drives evolution. It's the rate at which those particular changes are selected for in individuals, so the extent to which that new change will spread in a population. Is there anything changed about the rate at which a new variant, be it introduced by what you might call natural mutation or by CRISPR technology, is there anything that's going to change the rate at which that spreads in the population? Because that's really how evolution works.
Infertility is something that we have in many ways conquered. There's still mothers and fathers to be that are challenged by it. But there are many individual mutations that lead to a lack of fertility. We have drugs now, we have in vitro fertilization, we have a variety of ways in which those genes that have caused the infertility are getting passed on to the next generation. Those have other traits likely associated with them, otherwise they wouldn't exist. And so we actually are seeing in the population infertility genes that are being carried forward that normally would not at a pace that's unprecedented in history. I think the first generation we're seeing in terms of human harnessing all the technologies is to eliminating bad genes. It's fundamentally a human nature to want to have children and good outcomes. So this will, in the near term, eliminate inborn childhood errors of metabolism and other things. We're already seeing proof of that. So we're going to see large changes genetically in getting beneficial genes into the population, either selectively or not. In terms of adding traits that are actually driving through the population, we haven't engaged in that discussion largely among the human interventions yet, but I think we are seeing ways to eliminate the bad diseases.
You know, when you're born today in Massachusetts, you have 69 tests for genetic conditions. A bunch of them you can fix. Before a whole series of populations choose to have children, they often have genetic tests to see if they're both carriers of X, Y, or Z. Before in vitro eggs are implanted, you often have pre-implantation diagnostics. And these are technologies which are becoming so widespread for so many people that many of the traits that would be naturally passed on, many of which are harmful, because as Steve said, we're focusing on the harmful stuff first, are being very rapidly eliminated from human genomes and from what gets passed on to kids, because you're eliminating whole sets of carriers. So you're seeing them in the same way as you selected out polio and you selected out smallpox, and that is no longer what used to be a huge driver of human selection. you're now selecting out a whole series of gene traits and eliminating them from big chunks of the human population.
You're talking about all these different things which are influencing the evolution of humans. Perhaps we can just look ahead. Where do you see this going? What do you think the future holds for humans as a species?
So the first place in which the kind of change we're talking about are occurring in terms of taking control of evolution, certainly of humans is and other species, is actually, in the case of humans, taking on diseases where there is a significant problem. In the case of crops and animals, we're actually trying to bring in traits more quickly that make them resistant to diseases, as well as growing in climates they might not otherwise. So I think these are traditional ways of looking at traits that we want to be more beneficial. But going forward, we actually have, and this is the cultural aspect that Mark is talking about, we have a well-worn history that individuals do enjoy enhancing their performance and do enjoy trying to take on aging and beauty. We've seen this with Botox, LASIK, EPO, a lot of other things. And that's where we begin to bump into the ethical concerns. But the technologies at hand do have the potential to actually modify the ways in which individuals grow up and live and age and look at beauty.
One of the things that you mentioned in the book, which is sort of an interesting concept, I'm sure that Mark will want to jump in and ask a couple of questions about this as well, is this idea that, you know, you could end up with lots of different human species. I mean, how feasible do you think that really is?
Well, it's normal and natural to have many different versions of hominids walking around. And we interbred with at least two of them, with Denisova and with Neanderthals. We came so close to being extinct, as did the other 32 or 33 versions of hominids, that there's more variation in a troop of 55 West African chimps today than there are in 7 billion humans in genetic terms. So diversity is common, it is natural, and it probably wouldn't be the worst thing for humanity to have variants of humans or humanoids.
So technically it will be possible. I think it comes back to Mark's comment about cultural influences and how we actually go forward with it.
And it becomes a question, do we want it?
I mean, it depends on what you define as a species, really. You can define Neanderthals or Denisovans as different species if you want, but under a biological species concept, well, we clearly interbred with them and they're here now. I mean, you know, there's a bit of Neanderthal here and a tiny bit of Denisovan here in this room. So if you're arguing, do we increase diversity? Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, large population sizes maintain large amounts of diversity, but it takes a long time for it to accumulate. I do worry about this idea of a trajectory for evolution. I mean, evolution doesn't have a trajectory. It can give that appearance with the benefit of hindsight, but really it doesn't. There is no trajectory. You know, it's essentially a random walk through the space of possible biological forms that's only pruned by natural selection. So the idea that it would ever have a particular direction just seems crazy to me.
Is there the potential, though, if a technology comes along and people start deciding that having children naturally is too risky, that genetic variation, that random mutations are too great a risk to lead to, that people start, and this is very futuristic and it's all speculative, but is there a potential that a technology could be adopted where everyone ends up going through IVF if they're going to have offspring, and that then does start bringing in intentional changes that start to come towards what these guys are talking about, where humans start having control of their own evolution? Because at the moment, this stuff is, I mean, certainly with CRISPR and gene editing, this, you know, no germline stuff of that has happened. It's all, you know, it's not an issue right now. But let's say it did become a widespread thing. I mean, that's maybe just, I don't know how possible that is. But presumably then these kinds of possibilities are on the table, are they not?
I agree with you. So, I mean, the first thing is that we do have a form of that technology in that, well, firstly, we've always had a form of that technology and we choose who to mate with. Mm-hmm. Secondly, we have pretty advanced ways of doing pre-implantation screening now so that we can choose embryos that don't carry particular traits that we do. That could go further, of course. You could potentially, in the future, screen actual sperm cells. So you have much, much, much more choice about the particular combinations of genomes that you pass on. There would be less choice with egg cells because there aren't so many of them. So potentially, yes. And then you could directionally knock in particular changes using, for example, CRISPR technology. Although I would suggest that virtually all the variation that you would want to play with is already present in the human genomes of the world population anyway, because there's a lot of us. At the end of the day, those technologies that knock in, that do genome editing, they rarely affect, well, they're not at the moment such that they will be inherited to the next generation. So that's not really relevant from the point of view of human evolution.
Down the line, there is a possibility that it could be used for germline.
Well, absolutely. I mean, yeah, that is possible. I mean, the natural thing to do would be to do it at the implantation stage. Then you've so that these are possible. I mean, but what traits are you going to choose? I mean, this is very much the same as the example that was given earlier with dogs. So, you know, if you want to choose, I want to choose my dog to have, I don't know, long floppy ears or something like that. Well, I'm not going to come up with the idea unless I've seen a dog with long floppy ears, in which case nature, I don't really like using that term, but nature has already provided me with a dog with a gene with long floppy ears, so I'll just breed that one. And that's what we did. So I don't think, unless we can identify new functionalities and new traits that have not existed in nature before or are not possible, and I very much doubt there are any. Genomes are very fluid, plus a mutation means that you can actually generate more or less anything that we could come up with on a blackboard. You can actually generate, and probably does exist at some form in the human population.
Steve, Juan, what do you think about that? I mean, do you feel that nature's already provided us with all the tricks that we could want to choose from?
I think it's considering what humans could and desire to be generations from now in a very, very narrow context. I think we've already seen, we're going to see this not in humans first, but we're already seeing transfer of traits from one species to another. You know, a miniature elephant is a pet. A miniature pig was already done in China. I think the idea that there is some change that is unpalatable to us today, but is certainly within the realm of possibility, is going to occur in the future, once it's proven to be safe and affordable.
And I think you've already seen this almost everywhere but humans. I mean, if you look at the plants that we're planting today, many of them have been deliberately modified to do things which many people would consider unnatural. They grow at different speeds. They're tolerant to herbicides. They are tolerant to drought. They're tolerant to salt. Now, some of those are natural traits that probably would not have been driven through the environment. They would occur in 1 in 10 million, and now they occur in everything in a field of 10 million, and that happens within a decade. And you will see, probably as soon as you see a trait that eliminates a single letter in your 3.2 billion letters that does away with cystic fibrosis, we will try and do away with cystic fibrosis and eliminate cystic fibrosis by altering the gene code of kids who were born. Now, whether that is done through CRISPR, whether that is done through pre-implantation diagnosis, there's the whole point is we have so many instruments to alter the traits we pass on and how fast we pass on those traits that you will have a whole series of traits driven through because we choose them. And then the second part, that there's nothing unnatural. Look, there's a guy called Floyd Ronsberg who is sitting over in California who's been able to substitute two of the base pairs of DNA so that you now have DNA-like replication with four letters, but two of which are alternate letters, which means you could probably eventually create a whole series of plants that are immune to all viruses on this planet and that create a completely parallel evolutionary tree. So this notion that there's nothing new under the sun, I just don't buy it. I think one of the interesting things we have to debate is, as you are able to drive these traits, as you're able to develop these traits, as these traits come into the hands of college kids and basic labs, as this technology spreads and gets faster, better, cheaper, what are we going to do with this technology and how's it going to drive it and what are we going to allow and what are we not going to allow? I think we're way past the stage of debating whether it is happening and whether, you know, there's an absolute step change in our control over what lives and what dies and what the gene code or the gene code expression is and what lives and what dies.
Perhaps I can just wrap up with this sort of final question there, which is, you just sort of mentioned there that it comes down to what we're going to do with this. And presumably, you know, there's a huge field of ethical questions which crop up when you start talking about how we might direct human evolution. Surely that is one of the biggest brakes that could ever be put on this kind of technology, and perhaps rightly so.
That's exactly the debate we need to start having, and we need to start educating people, because the ability to read and write life and edit life is the single greatest power that humans have ever come up with. You know, we can use it for a whole bunch of stuff that will enormously benefit humans. We will improve medicines, we'll make chemicals in different ways, we'll store incredible amounts of information. I mean, every aspect of humanity changes in the same way as the digital revolution changed all of us. But there's also a series of pitfalls that we have to be wary of and that we have to understand. And to do that, the first principle we have to adopt is we are now partially in charge of what lives and dies on this planet and what gene code gets passed on. And that puts us in a parallel evolutionary logic to Darwin and Wallace. And as soon as you understand the implications of that, then you begin to really take the question you're asking seriously, which is, what are we going to do with this power, as opposed to debating, does this power exist? And I think what Steve and I are saying is, yes, this power exists. Now, how are we going to manage it? How are we going to deal with it?
Mark, would you like to just finish up with a comment on that?
Well, I mean, I agree that there are interesting, exciting, powerful, and to some extent scary technologies being developed. I think that they do empower us to change traits biologically. They will ultimately get into the gene pool. I don't see that that is a fundamental difference with standard evolutionary theory. Evolutionary theory accommodates it perfectly comfortably, but that doesn't change that there are debates to be had. I just don't think that talking about a new age of evolution is particularly helpful.
Juan and Steve's book, Evolving Ourselves, is published now by One World. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Mark Thomas, Juan Enriquez, Steve Gullins, and Ian Sample. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.